Gateway Market and Cafe is Des Moines' locally owned grocery and specialty food store, centrally located at ML King Parkway and Woodland Ave. Enjoy chef-crafted prepared foods, artisan baked goods, organic produce, hand-cut meats, local and international cheeses, wines, and craft beer. Gateway's Cafe is open for dine-in, carry-out, and delivery service 7 days a week. Stop by or visit gatewaymarket.com for more details. Gateway Market, good food, great community. Hey folks, welcome to the Fallon Forum. This is Ed Fallon, your host, with Charles Goldman, and we're broadcasting from the heart of America's heartland, Des Moines, Iowa. We got content today that'll be relevant to you wherever you live in this country of ours. Underwriting for the program by Gateway Market, a Des Moines grocery and cafe offering artisan, local, and global foods, and catering for business and social events. More information at gatewaymarket.com. And the bumper music for this program provided by the Des Moines Irish Session. Hey, Charles, welcome to the program. How you been?
Pretty good.
Enjoying the weather?
It's not bad.
Yeah. It's not 120 degrees like it is some places in the world.
Well, we just got back from the East Coast, and it's extraordinarily humid, torrential rains at times, so pretty extreme weather.
Yeah, we've had it relatively easy here in the upper Midwest.
Yeah, it's not been too bad here compared to, especially the coast.
Yeah.
You know. And then, of course, out west there's been no rain, or else where there was snow, it melted so quickly that it's of no use in terms of being able to drink it.
Yeah. But of course,
AI, data centers can get a hold of it.
Data centers, they need that stuff, right? And you know what, Charles, come on. You know, you've been listening to Donald Trump. You know that climate change is a hoax.
Oh, total hoax.
Yeah. You're still in denial?
No.
Yeah. I mean,
climate's going to climb it. It doesn't matter. They can deny it all they want.
Yeah. Yeah, no, he's arguing that, but one of his arguments is that, you know, all this climate change stuff is just getting in the way of economic development. You know, Bill McKibben had a really good take on why that is just, you know, a crock, and all the positive things that could come from real, you know, climate action, and all the problems that are associated with climate denial.
Well, there's plenty of money to be made in redoing our infrastructure to be more climate friendly. But that means that companies that have an overriding influence in our politics will have the lost cost of oil that's never removed, or natural gas that's never removed from the ground. Because ultimately, it would be a completely different energy picture if we were actually worried about the climate.
Yeah. I mean, McKibben points out, you know, the in 2025, renewables helped to avoid an estimated $480 billion in fossil fuel costs. I mean, despite Trump, you know, putting the kibosh on several wind projects and...
Let's be clear. Putting the kibosh on them, he actually just recently paid one of the companies that was developing, you know, wind farm off of the Northeast, $1.2 billion not to complete the project. Essentially, paid them, bribed them to give back the federal lease that they had.
You know, if Trump were to offer me a big chunk of money to go off the air, I might consider it.
The whole thing is ludicrous. You know,
don't do this. Here's a big check.
It's very clear that the future of energy use in this country and around the world is going to be tied to electrification. So the issue is really, what is the best way to make electricity? And we, of course, as a country, are falling behind other countries. You know, I love one of the things that, you know, Trump loves to say, which is that China, they just export their windmills. No, actually, China is the largest producer of wind energy. They're also the largest user of coal energy for electrification, because they are essentially the factory for the entire world at this point. You know, the one that Trump wants us to be again, to manufacture everything here.
But not wind turbines.
Right. And his three critiques of wind have been: one, they cause cancer, unknown to anybody where he got that from. Number two, he doesn't like the way they look because
there's so much uglier.
Because there was some off of his Scottish golf course, you know, And the third is, well, once those, you know, wind turbines and the blades are obsolete, they're a disposal problem, as opposed to coal ash.
Yeah, but that actually is a good criticism. There is a disposal issue, but yeah, coal ash.
Compared to coal ash and the product of nuclear reactors, the waste product of nuclear reactors, I think we can deal with bunch of blades.
I think you missed what I thought was Trump's number one objection to windmills. The birds fall dead to the ground.
Well, no, actually, his new one was it's a national security risk. Because supposedly these wind farms interfere with the radar that the military uses, but that's already taken into consideration when they get leasing. That's already been looked at, and they get clearance actually from the Pentagon that it's not going to be a problem. Hmm. So it's completely irrational. I mean, literally, $1.2 billion was spent to not bring electricity online for 5 million households.
Wasn't that wind farm off the coast of New England, wasn't it 75% done?
Yes, completed? That's why they had to pay him so much money. But he's done it to a couple of other ones, too. We're literally paying people to stop projects that would create more electricity. You know, we've talked about this before in the program. The problem is you can bring as much production as you want online, but unless it's decentralized production like solar, you have to hook it up with the grid. The grid is obsolete. The grid was built in the 50s, 1950s. And we've talked about before that you don't actually need more leasing and buying of land to put up more towers. You just need to improve the wires that connect the towers. Because a big problem with the old wiring is you lose like 30-40% of the energy that's being transmitted to heat because of the resistance of the conduction material.
Energy produced by wind turbines.
No, anything that's being put into the grid.
Oh, okay, anything going on the wires.
Anything that's going on the wires. Yeah. You know, all that is where we should be going because that's the future. And we're going back to the past, you know.
Well, the past is where his oil buddies want to be.
That's correct.
And I
think McKibben also pointed out that the natural gas, you know, the love affair with natural gas is misplaced, that it's a public relations scheme. It's not cleaner than coal. It's just different than coal.
Well, and it certainly smells cleaner. But the problem is the methane emissions are hugely impactful.
Correct, because if you count the methane from the fracking, which of course they don't want to monitor anymore, right? That essentially the effect on climate change is pretty similar.
So I just wonder how much long-term damage this climate change is a hoax administration is going to inflict. I mean, it's hard to know.
But it's hard to know, but I think the world is running past the United States, right?
With China.
And ironically, there are states in this country that are also basically turning their back. The biggest wind producer, or the second biggest wind producer, is Texas.
Yeah, yeah. Iowa's, what, third, I think?
I'm not sure. I think New Jersey's like third or fourth. And
New Jersey's up there?
Yeah, I think California may be the biggest or the second to Texas. Mm. But the point is that, yeah. And you know, it's interesting because one of the things with AI and these data centers would be that a decentralized energy production mechanism like wind turbines, solar, with, you know, improving battery technology would allow them to run that without actually stealing electricity from the people around them, who then get charged more for their electricity too. Mm-hmm. But instead, I think the one that Meta recently opened is using like a reopened coal plant.
Yeah.
I mean, why don't they just have like horses, you know, going around? like 10 horses stuck to something that turns magnet.
The Humane Society would have a field day with that.
I mean, it's ludicrous. Reopening a coal plant.
Well, I'm surprised there aren't people within the Republican Party that are opposed to Trump's climate denial. I mean, here in Iowa, when I was a legislator back in the early 90s, Republicans were opposed to anything to do with wind. And then once the investor-owned utilities, MidAmerican and Alliant, got on board and realized, hey, we could build these wind turbines, then suddenly Republicans are okay with it. And then after we got going on building them here, everybody was on board. I mean, even Steve King, a former U.S. congressman, even former
when he wasn't
governor,
busy reading Mein Kampf,
right? Even former Governor Terry Branstad, even Chuck Grassley, they're all on board with wind energy. So I'm surprised that we don't see some rebellion within the Republican ranks regarding Trump's absolute dismissal of wind. I mean, especially in states like Texas, like California, like Iowa, where you see significant investment and, you know, significant cost savings to customers and a heck of a lot. I mean, there's a lot of jobs associated with it. Jobs that would be jobs that are challenging, jobs that require going up 250 feet or higher, you know, in the air, and lots of jobs anyway. So, you know, but if we can segue a bit here for Charles, I was interested to see the Senate Republicans, U.S. Senate Republicans, join the Democrats back in July 29, just a couple weeks ago, in a unanimous vote. They passed a non-binding resolution opposing any presidential pardon or clemency for Ghislaine Maxwell. And that says volumes right there, that the entire U.S. Senate was willing to get on board and make sure that Trump, you know, let them know that they don't want to see Trump giving this criminal a pardon or clemency. Because and the reason they do that, of course, because he has said it many times, oh, yeah, maybe I consider that. I don't know what I'd do, you know. He's being very coy, but clearly, I mean, what I think, tell me what you think. I think that he sees a possible pardon to Maxwell in exchange for certain levels of cooperation from her regarding the Epstein files.
Well, I think there'd be no other reason for him to give her a pardon other than he wants her to say what she's already said, that whenever she saw Donald Trump with Jeffrey Epstein, he always was quite the gentleman. So take that for what it's worth. But I don't know. I'm unimpressed, because the same profiles in Courage that passed that resolution also just voted to make, you know, Todd Blanche the Attorney General.
Right, even Bill Cassidy, who had nothing to lose.
Bill Cassidy, who said that, you know, he I don't know how we find these people. he talked about how he read about all the great Senate debates of the past, and that he was really honored, and I can't remember the exact word he used, to be, you know, the person who had to make this decision, you know, this meaningful decision. All of them just going along. And here's somebody who they could have asked about why didn't they ask him much about Ghislaine Maxwell? Why didn't somebody ask him, you know, what did you talk about? Right? I mean, I know they've already asked him this, but of course he was very cagey.
Right.
You know, and all the things related. We passed a law that all of these files are supposed to be out in public. Mm-hmm. And there's still 2 to 3 million of them that you have. Why? That's violating a law that we passed almost unanimously.
They'd call you piggy or something.
You know, it's just...
Who knows?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I think that it's interesting that the Senate Republicans cast this vote. I don't think there's much of a rebellion happening. There's a bit more at the grassroots level. I mean, there's a portion of the MAGA base that are starting to say, huh? And I met a bunch of them when I was out on my 220-mile walk last fall.
Yeah.
And I think that's only that number has only grown. But I'm more intrigued actually with the rebellion within the Democratic Party. I mean, you've got, by the way, I just see the New York Times, NPR. All these legacy media that use the word centrist and moderate to describe Democrats they like, it's so wrong. There's nothing centrist about them. There's nothing moderate about them. They're pro-establishment, pro-status quo, pro-corporate. And they're losing. They're losing. There's a rebellion. The rebellion within the Democratic Party is real. And it's definitely not going away. And the big test, I think, will be in November, whether some of these candidates that are not cozy with the establishment, whether some of them actually prevail. And I think they might.
Okay. Like whom?
Well, I think, and I'm blanking on his name, the candidate who took Graham Plattner's place in Maine.
Well, he's hardly a... I guess the question I have is, your feeling is that the people who are being painted as DSA, many of whom are not.
Yeah, look, El Said in Michigan, he's not a DSA person. He was endorsed by them. I'm not sure he wanted that endorsement, but I'm not sure it did him any good. But yeah, I mean, yeah, in some places, being a DSA-endorsed candidate is not a bad idea. New York City comes to mind. parts of California, who knows where. It's not a great tag here in Iowa.
Right.
There is a DSA chapter in Des Moines. They're fairly fringe, but I think the candidates that are saying we're tired of the party selling out to corporate interests and we're going to focus on bread and butter issues, despite the fact that those corporate interests that pay the Democratic Party don't want us to, we're going to do that, and it's winning. It's prevailing, and I think it'll prevail in the general election as well.
I think that's really the key, which is, I don't think anybody really truly cares, and I think even the Republicans are misreading the times. Coming out with as Trump and others are doing, which is they're all communists. These are not people. The young people of this country don't remember 1950s McCarthyism, right? And the older people remember 1950s McCarthyism with it's not fond memories.
Yeah.
So campaigning as though they're all communists. They're not. I don't think most of these candidates who are seen as, you know, being portrayed as socialists or communists could actually even talk about Marx, and nor should they, because all the people care about ultimately is, what are you going to do for me? And the problem right now is they want to get paid more for what they do.
They want,
they're sick of seeing
affordable
people at the top having everything turned towards themselves. That's why even finally people are tiring, even on the Republican side, of the corruption, the overt corruption of the entirety of this administration. Every one of them is involved in some scheme and making money off taxpayers.
Hey, I want to switch gears and talk about the kind of religious angle to the Trump administration. I got to take a short break, though, and a reminder that underwriting for this program is provided by Dr. David Drake, a psychiatrist serving patients in Iowa and Colorado. More information at 515-229-5085. Ed Fallon and Charles Goldman with you back in a minute.
Thanks to Central Iowa realtor Joe Henry. Residential, commercial, land, Joe Henry's been covering all that for 23 years. He's also a leading community activist and a strong advocate for locally owned businesses. Call Joe Henry at 515-208-7312. That's 515-208-7312. You're responsible for a lot, and it's easy to become overwhelmed, to feel helpless, even hopeless. What's not so easy is finding your way back to feeling and functioning better. Psychiatrist Dr. David Drake helps individuals and couples throughout Iowa with the convenience and privacy of televideo counseling. Dr. Drake also prescribes medication when needed, and his services are offered on a self-pay, negotiated fee basis. If you need help, don't delay. Contact Dr. Drake at daviddrakefamilypsychiatry.com.
Hey, welcome back to the Fallon Forum. Ed Fallon with you here today, folks. Charles Goldman as well. And we're coming to you from the almost the direct center point of the U.S., Des Moines, Iowa. Hey, underwriting for the program provided by real estate agent Joe Henry. More information at 515-208-7312. All right, so we have talked about this before. It's worth talking about again, especially since things keep evolving. But Charles, you're deeply enmeshed in paying attention to all the details relevant to the kind of the connection between Trump's fascism and his kind of his Christology.
Right. You know, as he was once famously asked, which of the testaments do you read the most? The Old Testament and the New Testament. He said both.
Yeah. Playing it safe. Didn't want to offend the Old Testament people.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. But we made him president anyway after that. He said that, I think, 2015. What is interesting is that a couple things came up over the last couple of weeks that are very much part of the rewriting of history of the United States that is part and parcel of the Christian nationalist movement, of which Trump has been a huge beneficiary.
I really don't think he cares, but he's been...
Well, he doesn't care. I mean, but he understands that these are people who are very persuaded by his painting anybody who disagrees with him and his policies as somebody who hates the United States. And because there's this whole academic sort of wing that has really been banging very hard on the idea that this is and was founded as a Christian nation, it's very much part of the MAGA movement. It's almost inseparable from the MAGA movement. And it's also why some of the apostolic Protestants, have moved towards the MAGA movement and have given it a lot of its exceptionalism. The exceptionalism being that only white Christians are really the true descendants of those from the Mayflower. And of course, the person who's more than Trump is a spokesman for this is Vance.
Vance.
Yeah. You know,
I thought you were going to say Stephen Miller.
Well, Stephen Miller, obviously, but Vance is out there, talking essentially a sanitized blood and soil kind of view.
Tell me about blood and soil.
Well, that it's the push against the idea that a nation of immigrants, of diverse peoples, is stronger than one that was homogeneous. And the homogeneous nation, which of course you could read as the Aryan nation, as it was called in the 1930s, are really the only ones who can push the United States forward. And it also is why so much of the past, it's a backward-looking movement. It was a backward-looking movement in Nazi Germany, too, in the 30s. It was looking backwards, and that's what they're doing. And what they're doing is, particularly like in the recent move to put the signs on the Smithsonian American History Museum, put the signs outside it, because they couldn't put it in it because the Smithsonian's a private institution. But the Park Service owns the sidewalks outside. That there's misinformation inside, and then you should go to this website.
Like slavery was bad, for example.
Well, that slavery wasn't all that bad because the slaves learned some skills. They learned some work skills.
And Native Americans weren't the victims of attempted
genocide. The point
genocide.
Is that they claim that everything in the museum or the thrust of the museum is to say things that, while they may be historically true, it's a point of emphasis. And that they downplay all the greatness and exceptionalism in the United States. Mm. Right. To the point, of course, that a lot of it is that they want to rewrite the history entirely. Mm-hmm. I mean, so, this whole, let's look at January 6th, right?
2021.
Right.
Yeah.
The whole history of that is being rewritten by Trump, right? It was patriots, right, who were trying to take back the country from the elites, right? And they were duped by all the FBI agents and informants who were really the ones who were pushing them forward.
Who were waving them in.
Right, correct.
Right,
yeah. Well, they said, yes, they were talking, that was the police who didn't want to get trampled and beaten up with flagpoles that may have waved them in.
Yeah.
But and rewriting history means you also have to go back and rewrite it. And so anything that's in a museum that says, well, this is what slavery was, this is who benefited from slavery, it has to be recast.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the thrust. It's a very classic authoritarian thrust.
So tell me where I'm wrong. The original colonists, whether they be Dutch or English or French, were often, not always, they were coming for opportunities sometimes, but oftentimes they were fleeing religious persecution. They were religious, they were Christian. They were often,
not all of them.
No, but they were often coming from, most of them, I would think. So, I can see how the right would make that argument. I can see the foundation at which they're trying to build it. But it totally bypasses the fact that, yeah, not all early Americans were of the... same Christian perspective, and the Constitution is pretty clear about the separation of religion from the workings of government.
Well, that of course is the biggest, roadblock, and you have a judiciary that was brought up in the Federalist Society, which is very much about saying that that's a misreading of the Constitution.
Now, how do they read it?
That there's nothing in there that says that, it simply says you can't establish a state religion. In other words, you can't thrust onto the people a religion that the state determines is the only one that matters. But
that's what a white Christian nationalist nation, or that's what that's
about. Well, of course, that's the whole point. That's exactly what they would be doing by excluding others who don't believe the same way they do.
Right.
You know, that Jesus is their savior. And, you know, the other problem, the real problem they have is the very people who wrote the Constitution hated organized religion. If you read Jefferson, you read Madison.
Franklin as well, you know, I imagine.
And Franklin, Paine, they, especially Madison and Jefferson, blamed the organized churches of Europe for most of the strife on the continent. And the last thing they wanted was to have a religious basis for the United States.
So how come the political left or right or whatever you want to call the people who don't want to see a religious state established here, how come they don't cite those readings more often?
Because it's like the Bible. You just pick the ones that fit what you want to believe.
But the readings of Paine and Jefferson, Madison.
Why don't they?
Yeah, how come we aren't hearing those more often? How they were opposed to the establishment of a religion.
Because this has been a project of many, many years. Heritage Foundation,
sure.
Federalist, bunch of other organizations, a fundamentalist.
Supreme Court.
Apostolic Christianity. Supreme Court, obviously, yeah. is a product of that. It's an inconvenient truth. Right? Yeah. The Federalist Papers are pretty clear. So
I would think our side, those of us who value the separation of church and state, would be reading that stuff constantly, citing it constantly, talking about it all the time.
Because the media never goes past the First Order. No. All they ever say is the Constitution, you know, says that there's a separation between church and state. Those words aren't in the Constitution. The words taken together come up with that, right?
So some media. I'm setting us up for a future conversation, maybe actually probably multiple conversations about these readings from early Americans who did not want to see a church established in the U.S.
Well, no, it's probably the number one person who didn't want a church established in the United States was Jefferson. Jefferson, I think, spent after he was president, spent most of the rest of his life rewriting the Bible in a way that was a lot less about a anthropomorphized male God and more about a more universalist version of Christianity. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's not surprising that a group of organization and philosophers and thinkers who believes that authoritarianism and concentrated power in some sort of sovereign would be a better way to rule than a messy democratic republic. So they fit their religious iconography and interpretations to fit what they want to have.
So let's talk about something happening here in Iowa. Then I want to ask you a big picture question. But you're here in Iowa, the Republican trifecta at the State House established the Center for Intellectual Freedom, and I believe at the University of Iowa.
Yeah.
And you're a big fan.
Well, you know, it comes from, if you look at it from a non-tribal side, you know, it's trying to address something that is truly absent in American education, which is a true civics course, right? You know.
But where they're coming from is...
Well, hold on a second.
Okay,
but
sure.
I mean, there's nothing wrong with teaching civics. It should have been taught way before you go into college.
Yeah. Okay.
I mean, this is how you end up with, you know, if not the most illiterate senator in the Senate, U.S. Senate, the second most illiterate senator, Tommy Tuberville, who believes that there's only two branches of government. Okay.
Has he said that?
Yeah.
And they are?
I think he included the military as the third branch. He left out the courts.
Okay. Well.
So there is a need for teaching civics. We're obviously doing a pretty crummy job. In fact, you know, I think they've done studies where they take the test that they give for naturalization for immigrants, and they give it to like Americans who were born here.
And they fail.
And a huge percentage of can't pass any of the information about our country. So anyway, they put this together, and of course the subtext of this was that it was a necessary corrective to the fact that most universities have a liberal, progressive lean to their faculties. And I think that's true. That, you know, most of the large universities and elite colleges, for the most part, are predominantly people who would agree with you and I on many, many things. And everybody figured out this, you know, the curriculum is still not even together, right? They had like a one credit course that they ran this year, and they had 64 spots and only 21 were filled. The rumor, I think, or one of the articles I read about it, was that there was only one person enrolled for next year, which is when they decided that maybe they need to rethink writing a curriculum. And also, you know, the legislature, from what I understand, is trying to push U of I, or push the regents into forcing U of I to make it a required course.
Well, and again, part of where this is coming from is the Iowa Republican legislature's kind of conservative Christian bent.
Well, it will be, I assume a lot of it will be like listening to that professor at Hillsdale, Hansen. You know, it'll be about American exceptionalism.
Yeah.
You know,
So let me ask you, I mean...
And if anything, I would say that our present times really call into question American exceptionalism. It seems to me that what we're seeing is we're just as bad as any other nationalist state ever has been, you know, in terms of being able to...
Empires specifically.
Yeah.
Yeah. So let me ask you this. We've been around a long time. We remember when the kind of radical Christian extremism was really just on the fringe. The moral majority, and you know, I mean, it was having an impact, but right now it has reached the highest level of office. It is embedded in the administration with people like Stephen Miller and J.D. Vance and Russell Bowen.
Hold on a second. I mean, Stephen Miller's not even a Christian.
Yeah, but he'll be happy to use elements of Christianity to establish. Well, I mean, I think the guy's basically a fascist.
Bringing
Christianity and fascism together works as a totalitarian mix, just like we've seen religion and fascism work very well in other countries of the world, not necessarily Christian but Muslim. Let me just say it, Jewish. I mean, what's happening right now in Israel? I mean, how is that not as bad as any mix of faith and politics? But I think here. It's heading that way. It's heading that way. And are we quick enough to the draw to be able to cut it off?
I don't know. I mean, it's the end result of a project that started in the 1970s, which was the Republicans' realization that fundamentalists / apostolic Christians could be manipulated into aligning with the Republican Party on the issue of abortion. Remember, the Republican Party was not anti-abortion legalization until the 70s. And it didn't even come upon the issue until years after Roe v. Wade, probably mid-70s. Mm-hmm. You know, and then you had Paul Weyrich and other operatives, you know, like Phyllis Schlafly, who saw that as an issue. What's happened is the dog caught the car, which is the Republicans, just, you know, like the industrialists thought they can control Hitler, the Republicans thought, this is great, we'll just keep stringing this issue along for as long as we can, and that will get us the support from this group of fundamentalist, you know, Christians, mostly Protestant sects, and some of the more Opus Dei type Roman Catholics. And now they've caught the party. They're running the show. And that's exactly right. And they are definitely infiltrated in multiple levels of the federal government. And that is a little bit scary.
Yeah, and we talk about this a lot, but there's always something new breaking. What's your status right now, doctor, as to the life support system of democracy? How's it looking?
we're definitely in critical care. You know, we're in the ICU. And I don't think that, I think the salvation may be that we only have a couple of more months before on the downside of what should be the last 2 years of the Trump administration. And, you know, he becomes a lot less powerful.
When he doesn't have a
compliant
Republican Congress.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and I think it would be something if he even had a Republican Congress that wasn't compliant. But gosh, when you see folks like Bill Cassidy, who have nothing to lose by standing up for what they say they believe in, caving, you know.
Actually, I mean, for Iowans, I think it's a sad watch, but most Iowans should take a look at the opening of the Judiciary Committee, you know, when they considered and passed the nomination of Todd Blanche on. Senator Grassley opened with a discussion of why Blanche was a great choice, including how he personally brought down the murder rate in the United States since 2022, of course. But it was sad. It was sad to watch somebody who, you know, I've interacted with and found him astute and, you know, a real public, well, yeah. One time he was a real public servant.
Chuck Grassley has the aw shucks, I'm the farm boy senator.
But more than that, I mean, he was somebody who understood the issues.
Yeah, and he was also independent.
Right.
I mean, I voted for him once, Charles. I don't know if you knew that.
No, I didn't know that.
Well, he and Mark Hatfield, the only two Republicans who opposed going to war the first time we went to war with Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
He was one of two Republicans who voted no.
Well, you should watch. It's only a 10-minute speech, but it's hard to watch.
Okay, I will watch it, but he's been hard to watch for the past 20, 30 years now. And it's just gotten worse and worse under Trump. And I'm afraid that's happened to other Republican, you know, lawmakers who may have at one time had an independent backbone.
Mm-hmm.
But you still see some that do express independence and exercise their own discernment. And then what happens? Well, go talk to Thomas Massie or Bill Cassidy or Cornyn in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, right now, there's a guy in charge of the Republican Party, and if you don't stay in line with him, you're in trouble. And I'm just wondering, Charles, you said, you know, democracy is in the ICU, but I'm feeling very encouraged by America's physicians. And that would be the voters, the independent media, the independent judicial. I mean, we do have judiciary, members of the judiciary who do still value independent thought. I mean, heck, Jeanine Pirro. I mean, voting against Trump's position on the reflecting pool. Small potatoes, maybe, but a significant stand that now has her in trouble. But good for her. I honestly anybody could have looked at the evidence and come up with a different conclusion, but still good for her. So, you know, we may be in the ICU, but I see a collective of physicians and other medical personnel that are pulling the right strings and making the right decisions. And, you know, if we can keep that going, I'd say we still have a shot at pulling democracy out of the ICU.
Well, I certainly hope so.
But you don't share my optimism.
At times I do.
At times I do.
I mean,
after a rousing speech like I just gave.
Exactly. Well, if the last thing I'll say is, if we want that to happen, we need to get rid of all political consultants. We need people who are campaigning and saying, this is what I believe.
I despise political consultants. I'm with you on that. Hey, I'm back in a minute, folks. A reminder that underwriting for the Fallon Forum provided by Western Optometry. More information at 515-789-3055. Ed Fallon and Charles Goldman with you here. I want to talk about mail-in ballots when we get back from a break.
Sure.
In a minute. Thanks to our nonprofit partners, including Circle of Peacemakers. Formerly the Catholic Peace Ministry, Circle of Peacemakers works with people of all faiths toward a world without war. CPM opposes runaway military spending while domestic needs go unmet. Instead of endless wars, CPM supports diplomacy. Visit circleofpeacemakers.com. At Westrom Optometry, Dr. Joel Westrom and his team provide a variety of services, including comprehensive eye exams, children's eye exams, and LASIK co-management. Whether strictly utilitarian or a fashion statement, your comfort and vision are Westrum's primary concern. Dr. Westrum and his staff will work closely with you to determine the best solution for your eyes, prescription, and lifestyle. Services are provided in English and Spanish, and the clinic is open Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. till 5 p.m. and on Saturdays by appointment. That's Westrum Optometry, located in Des Moines East Village. All right, welcome back, folks. Ed Fallon and Charles Goldman with you here. Hey, I'm underwriting for this program provided by Architecture by Synthesis. More at architecturebysynthesis.com. All right, Charles, so we're, what, 80-something days from the election?
Mm-hmm.
And there is a lot going on relevant to the many ways in which voting might be suppressed. One here in Iowa is that the GOP is suing to try to stop positive changes relevant to mail-in ballots.
Positive changes.
Iowa Republicans, again, with the cooperation of the national GOP, they're suing to restore Iowa's signature verification requirements. This is something that the legislature passed. Relevant to absentee ballots, there's a process now in place to verify the signatures on those ballots. This goes way back, actually. This is back in 2019. There was an injunction, and LULAC, the League of United American Citizens of Iowa, had sued the Iowa Secretary of State, Paul Payton. The injunction, and I believe it was from the Iowa Supreme Court, blocked Iowa's signature verification requirements for absentee ballots, and Republicans want to change that. They want to make sure that those requirements will be in place. And, of course, they want to be in place because they make it more difficult to vote absentee, to vote by mail.
Well, it's interesting. The reason that, you know, I sent this over to you is that I think this brings up some of the way this has been covered. You know, because especially with everything with Trump has been, we have to pass the SAVE Act,
Right. Right. And we're not passing the SAVE Act, apparently.
No, definitely. It's not going to happen.
Yeah.
You know, and it interested me because, well, first of all, I think the way it's been presented is kind of the way you present it, which is, well, it's to disadvantage people who would be primarily presumed Democratic voters.
Right.
The interesting thing is that there's been some research looking at, you know, by party and other things, the trends in absentee ballots being used in Iowa. And same thing nationally. There's a lot of Republicans, particularly in rural states, that use absentee ballots also.
Mm-hmm. Way more than they used to be.
Way more than used to be. In fact, in the presidential election, the most recent one, there were more absentee ballots sent in by Republicans than by Democrats.
Nationally?
No, here in Iowa.
Here in Iowa. Okay.
And in the midterms, the enthusiasm for midterms is always greater among Democrats.
But Republican operatives aren't stupid. They know what they're doing. They're doing it for a reason. And they have figured out that they have something to gain by challenging this 2019 ruling.
I don't know. I mean, I think a lot of Republican legislators are, they're not doing deep research on this.
No, they aren't. But the operatives are.
Perhaps.
Yeah, the consultants that you don't like.
But let's look at a state where they only do apps. They only do absentee ballots.
Think in Oregon?
Oregon.
Yeah. Okay.
Oregon has signature verification. I guess that's my question, which is how else do you verify that it is from the person? Now they have a different structure. First of all, they already have multiple signatures on record, because you know how you get your absentee ballot? You get it from the DMV.
Department of Motor Vehicles.
Motor Vehicles there, whatever they call it there. Yeah. Right? So they have a long history of what your signature looks like. Because let's face it, we don't hire people who are handwriting experts to look at your signature.
But part of the problem is, what is a signature anymore? I mean, when you sign the little gizmo they give you to pay your bill with your card, You don't sun. You just like put a line on it.
No, I think that's a great, that's a great question. That's a great question. But the point is that unless you have some reason to have a sequence of signatures, now, obviously, one of the problems is going to be is that, like, you know, like my 11-year-old, I don't think he's going to do anything the rest of his life except print, you know, because they don't teach cursive anymore.
Right.
So I don't know. But the point is that a state like Oregon has set the structure up so that they can do what would be considered a fair attempt at signature verification based on a sequence of signatures that they are already in possession of. And they have a whole system for doing it. What my problem would be here is there's no such system in Iowa. There's no such structure in Iowa.
So you're actually agreeing with the Republicans on this.
I'm agreeing that if you're going to absentee ballots, I have no problem with signature verification if you have a structure that allows that to be valid or at least attempt to be valid.
Okay. So, and I understand that, but my question then is, why are they fighting this? Why did they pass this law in the first place? And why are they bothering to file a suit now against the injunction? They must see something that we don't.
I'll tell you what they see, because it's what Trump and the operatives in Washington see, which is that if you get rid of mail-in balloting, even if you eliminate some of the voting by your own supporters in the rural areas, it doesn't matter that much, because the greatest number of people in this country, the vast majority of people in this country, live in cities now. And in cities, that then allows the states to shut down the places where you can vote in areas where they think, because of either ethnic composition or known voting patterns, Democratic-leaning people are going to be voting.
So this is a good point. So they will they'll sacrifice some of their own voters in rural communities, knowing that they'll get a bigger chunk of Democrats in urban centers unable to vote because of the requirement.
Or they'll have the one place you can vote on the University of Michigan, you know, that you can vote live. Right, and they'll shut down the hours that the drop-off voting will be available.
So in Iowa, I don't know how this is going to turn out. It may not change. The injunction preventing the signature requirement might hold. But what do you have any idea? Have you done any research in terms of what this looks like in other states?
Yeah.
Okay. So what's it look like in, say, Michigan? You mentioned Michigan.
Well, I don't know about Michigan, but I mean, you know, I think the best example is Oregon.
And in states where We're going to see a close election on U.S. Senate races, maybe U.S. House races.
I mean, I think the belief is that it will definitely affect local elections far more, or district elections for the legislatures far more than it will the larger scale elections. Because if you disenfranchise by virtue of it not being able to access a physical voting place. And a lot of these elections, I mean, how much did Miller Meeks win by?
Six. Yeah. Miller Meeks is the U.S. Congresswoman from Southeast Iowa.
Yeah, from like.
She won by 6 votes.
Right. And then I think.
4 years ago.
What was it? And then 2 years ago, it was like 88 or something. It was a little bit more, but it was still in the hundreds.
A few hundreds, 600
yeah,
maybe.
So the point is that changing availability for a couple hundred people could be a drastic change.
Or in some cases,
in
for
some
six
of these
people.
Smaller states.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, so, I mean, and I think it's a little bit unknowable, though, as to, it turns out. I mean, I was pretty interested in this study that was done by a poli-sci professor at U of I. You know, that actually it's getting increasingly close between the Republicans and the Democrats in absolute numbers. And in fact, Republicans by far return more of their absentee ballots than Democrats who request them.
Sure. Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
So I don't think it If of course I see what they're trying to do, and I also see it's just another way of saying none of this is valid. We understand that what they want to do in November
that's
is say
the biggest part
this
of
can't
it.
Be valid. This was stolen.
That's the biggest part of it. Right. I mean, that's why Trump even called into question the validity of California's primary back in June. You know,
it was the usual. Yeah. You know, I mean, the late coming votes were coming from the place that the district, the precincts in LA are most likely to have voted. You know, for the person who's progressive.
Yeah. Well, This is why, I mean, I'm encouraged to see that there's a lot of people in important positions relevant to election management who are paying attention to this and are preparing to address possible efforts by the Trump administration to negate the results of the election. It's going to be very interesting to see what happens. And again, pay attention, folks. You know, get involved. Speak out.
Go out and vote.
Listen to the Fallon Forum.
Go out and vote whatever side you're on. It may be the last chance you get to do it.
Yeah.
In any meaningful way.
Yeah. Hey, Charles, thanks for joining me today, folks. Charles Goldman has been with me here in the studio. And when we come back from a short break, Kathy Burns and I are going to be talking about state fairs, not just the Iowa one, but the oldest, the youngest, the biggest, the best. Back in a minute, folks, and underwriting provided by Dr. Kim Holding with Story County Veterinary Clinic, serving Story County pets for over 30 years. More information at Story County Veterinary Clinic's Facebook page. Architecture by Synthesis provides planning, design, and design build services for high performance, low maintenance, affordable homes and buildings. Owner Mark Clipsham asks that you use the most energy efficient methods you can afford and the greenest, longest lasting materials available. Examples of Mark's work can be found at architecturebysynthesis.com. That's architecturebysynthesis.com.
At Story County Veterinary Clinic, Dr. Kim Holding has over 30 years of experience working with all creatures, great and small. Cat, dog, horse, cow, elephant. Well, if you've got a pet elephant, you may be in trouble. Kim's clients stick with her year after year because they know she'll do right by them and their pets and farm animals. So give Kim a shout to keep your animals happy and healthy. Call 515-232-8766. That's 232-8766.
Welcome back to the Fallon Forum. Hey, underwriting for this show provided by Gateway Market, a Des Moines grocery and cafe offering artisan local and global foods and catering for business and social events. More information at gatewaymarket.com. Hey, Kathy, welcome to the program.
Hello.
And next week, we'll be recording on a different date because we're going to be going to the State Fair.
I know.
And I'm going to be doing the accordion competition.
I can't wait. Home that blue ribbon.
Well, I've brought over the years, I've won the accordion competition 3 times. We'll see if this is another year that I can pull it off.
That would give you a best in the category for that competition. And today we are going to be talking about state fairs. About the oldest one, the youngest one, and supposedly the biggest and the best. And some other general.
And we're not talking birth order.
Not here. Birth okay. Order, yeah.
So, yeah, who's the oldest one?
New York.
Really? I guess that doesn't surprise me.
That state fair started in 1841.
Wow.
In Syracuse.
And I would guess that the youngest, the most recent state to have a state fair be on the West Coast?
No. The hint is that they began their fairs before they were officially states.
Okay, help me out.
Alaska.
Okay.
In 1936 is the youngest, and it began as a community celebration for the Matanuska Valley colonists. The other youngest one by 1 year is Hawaii, 1937. Was a local trade show, and it highlighted industry and homegrown foods.
So I was close.
You were close. Yeah.
Okay. And you mentioned biggest.
There's several categories of biggest.
It's got to be Iowa, right?
No. Oh. And
no,
it,
really?
You need to look at it if it's by day or total through the year. But the biggest by daily attendance, Minnesota earned that in 2018. And they had, on a Saturday, 270,426 people gaining entrance to the fair. But the other way to look at that is by daily average in just 1 year. So Minnesota also holds the title of 177,000 average daily attendance in 1 year, and that was in 2019. The biggest by total attendance in 1 year.
Iowa?
Texas.
Oh, God.
Texas. And now they kind of cheat, though, because their fair goes sometimes almost twice as long as some of the other state fairs. So the highest total attendance was in their 1986 special anniversary fair. They had nearly 4 million visitors over 31 days.
That was so Texas is kind of in decline right now.
Texas. Well, then in a standard fair for Texas. They have the highest total of 2,547,000 and a few odd visitors.
You mean one day?
That's over 24 days.
Oh, average. Okay, gotcha.
Yeah.
Okay. So how does that compare with Iowa?
Iowa does fine. And we, our largest fair attendance over an 11-day event is 1,182,682. That was in 2024.
Okay. Yeah, and I'm trying to remember what the weather was like back then, because that does make a difference.
Big difference.
Yeah. So, okay, so we aren't the biggest. We're probably the best, right?
I think we're the best.
Okay.
But I've never been to another state fair.
So there are entities that rate bestness.
The information I could find was, it's a typical one, USA Today's Reader's Choice Awards ranks Minnesota.
Oh, come on.
Minnesota, you're really
Minnesota
kicking it. Way to go. Way to go, neighbors to the north.
I think they probably stuffed the ballot box.
So, people can do that in that USA Today. It's a vote thing, and you can vote multiple times.
Oh, so they did stuff the ballot box. Mm-hmm. All right. Mm-hmm. So we are the best.
Yes, let's say that. Let's say that.
We certainly are iconic. Wasn't the Iowa State Fair profiled in the musical State Fair?
Yes.
Yeah.
No, it was. I don't think it was. Yes, it was a musical.
Yeah.
It's a kind of a dark film in some ways. You know, people get into some serious situations, and it's not all la-ti-da. I think a young man or a young woman kind of goes off to the part of the State Fair at night where they're not supposed to be. But otherwise, the family packs a picnic and they try to win a blue ribbon of some kind. Not in accordion.
Not in the accordion competition.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's cool, though, that other countries have State Fair-like annual celebrations. There are some in every continent. Canada has the Canadian National Exhibition in Toronto. And others in Europe, the UK has what's called the Great Yorkshire Show, farming, local food, rural traditions. In Asia, the Chinese Farmers Harvest Festival is in autumn, scheduled in the autumn equinox. And in Africa, Zimbabwe and Zambia both have events that are very similar to state fairs.
Yeah, and it's all about farming.
It's all about farming.
And food. And so, in Iowa, it's about deep frying atrocious piece of food.
The food for sale is often deep fried. There are some very good foods at the fair.
The only deep fried thing I've ever had at the state fair is funnel cake.
I like funnel cake.
I do too, but I'm not going to eat a Twinkie deep fried.
No.
No. But we are going to go. Hey, folks, thanks to our production team of Sherry Herdina, Forrest Dedeman, Charles Goldman, and Kathy Burns. Thanks also to the Des Moines Irish Session for our bumper music. Underwriting provided by Gateway Marketing Cafe, Story County Veterinary Clinic, Western Optometry, David Drake Family Psychiatry, Architecture by Synthesis, and real estate agent Joe Henry. Also, Circle of Peacemakers, Iowa Physicians for Social Responsibility, Bold Iowa, Birds and Bees Urban Farm, and Climate March. This is Ed Fallon, your host of the Fallon Forum, back next week with another hour of cutting-edge talk radio.
State Fair is a great state fair. Don't miss it, don't even delay. It's dollars to donuts that our state fair is the best state fair in our state.